gonna go something like, I'm Jed, I'm Robert, it's Radiolab, and this... I can die a happy man. So that was perfect, so here we go. This is Radiolab, I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
And this... is the sound of 700 people who have come to bear witness to the recording of our show today. We are in the Fitzgerald Theater at St. Paul, Minnesota, talking about the strange phenomenon that is the War of the Worlds.
You know, it's very great that everybody's here, of course, but this there is one guy I really wish had been here.
Who's that?
The Ecuadorian guy, Leonardo, what's his?
Paez?
Yeah, yeah. Because he's the guy I want to ask, like, what were you thinking? That's what I want.
Yes. Well, he's dead.
He's dead, yeah. Well, but or Orson Welles, I would say to him, what were you thinking, I would say.
Dead.
Dead, yeah. How about the guy in Buffalo? Buffalo?
Missing? Retired? I don't know.
That's ask somebody, so I found a guy who I think is definitely alive.
I am Daniel Myrick, co-writer, co-director of The Blair Witch Project.
Before making The Blair Witch Project, Dan Myrick heard a recording of The War of the Worlds, which he was pretty young at the time. He was a teenager.
I just thought it was brilliant. Absolutely the coolest thing.
And more than anything else, he was impressed by the technique of the thing.
There's a couple of moments in particular where they cut to the kind of on-site reporter.
I'll return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's
Mill. And it's almost like cut in a second or two early, and you hear the reporter saying, so are we on?
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on?
Are we on?
Ladies and gentlemen.
And then he goes into character.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall.
And it's those little beats, those little moments that really make it convincing. I get this kind of guilty excitement when I know how it affected people.
Myrick never forgot that sense of guilty excitement. He was fascinated by the idea that scary stories get even scarier if you think they're true. So, years later, fresh out of film school, he and his friend Eduardo Sanchez decided to develop their own Wells-like project. It's your basic scary witch story. Three kids go into the woods.
Okay, we're leaving right now.
They get lost, they bump into the witch, and then they die, or they think they die. At least you never see them again. But when you entered the theater to see The Blair Witch Project, the first thing that you'd see on the screen are these two sentences. It would read, in October of 1994, three student filmmakers disappeared in the woods near Burkittsville, Maryland, while shooting a documentary. A year later, their footage was found. So the suggestion here is that what we see is not a movie with
actors. Never mind that you are in a movie theater.
Right.
And you paid $10 and have some popcorn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when you went and sat down, what you saw was something called found footage, shot by three kids who have gone missing. And so these kids, you're not sure, but they might be real.
Well, we picked a subject matter that was difficult to disprove to the casual observer. Mm. Martians invading from outer space is, you turn the channel to the next network, and if no one's reporting about it, it's pretty well assured it's probably fiction. But three missing students in the woods, you know, that's something that is a little harder to disprove without a fair amount of scrutiny.
And it worked.
We were getting calls from police wondering where these three kids were and how come they never heard of this case.
You're kidding.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was constant.
Oh, so people saw the whole thing and thought they saw something real.
Still do. I still get emails occasionally on what part of the story is real. You know, is there still any phenomena out in Burkittsville and da-da-da-da. It's all fiction and it's all made up. And I think it reinforces what I think Ed and I suspected, that so much of us wants to believe.
Some people told Dan Myrick that after watching those three campers go in the woods, they themselves would never go camping again. And he thought that was fabulous. He loved it.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah?
Well, why would you not want people to go camping? I mean, no, honestly, why would you do that to people?
Well, I asked him.
Well, I think that's the goal of any filmmaker. When you make a movie, whether you want people to laugh or cry or be scared, you're trying to affect people so viscerally and so emotionally that it has a resonating effect on them long after they've seen your movie. I mean, that's why you're doing it. You know, we're not making this movie to kind of scare people. We were making the film to really scare people. No regrets on people not wanting to go camping afterwards.
So, the question is that what Orson Welles was up to back in 1938? Was he just trying to give people a good old-fashioned show business scare, make them scream way up in the balcony? Because remember, at the time, that is what he claimed, that this was simply an entertainment.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
But 16 years later, Orson Welles changed the story. Here he is on the BBC. The year is 1955.
In fact, we weren't as innocent as we meant to be when we did the Martian broadcast. We were fed up with the way in which everything that came over this new magic box, the radio, was being swallowed. So in a way, our broadcast was an assault on the credibility of that machine. We wanted people to understand that they shouldn't swallow everything that came through the tap.
So here are two ways to think about the War of the Worlds. One, it was a smashing entertainment using every trick they could think of, including inventing some new ones, to scare you silly. Master storytelling. We're trying to send you a warning. Don't trust everything you hear on the radio. It's not always true.
So which one was it, you think?
Well, I asked the professor. Jason Lavilio.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Jason?
Him. He's a radio historian at the University of Maryland. He says that what Welles understood was that a newscast is often two things at once. In a newscast, you hear something scary or disturbing sometimes, but it's going to be told to you in a way that soothes you, meaning the authority of the voice, the newscaster's steady voice coming through the radio, it will calm you, like President Roosevelt's famous fireside chats.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking.
He's so calm. He's so in charge, says Professor Lavilio.
When you study the rhetoric that Roosevelt used, he really did convey two messages. One, we're in terrible danger. And two, I've got it covered. And that is the sort of the authoritative voice coming out of the darkness, this sort of invisible, disembodied voice of the powerful man, the news anchor.
September 22nd, 1940.
And we'll see this with Murrow on the rooftops of Britain.
I'm standing on a rooftop.
During the Blitz.
Looking out over London. Straight in front of me now, you'll hear two sounds in just a moment. There they are.
He's giving us a story of an unfolding emergency.
I should think in a few minutes there may be a bit of shrapnel around here.
But his mastery of the information, his mastery of his own voice, his bravery on the scene.
You may be able to hear the sound of guns off in the distance, very faintly, like someone kicking a tub.
This was the beginning of the formatting of fear, the formatting of crisis. It's sort of a ritual where we're sort of evoking a terrible danger and then somehow assuaging those fears through the performance of the news. And so people go to the news not to be afraid, but to be afraid and then to be reassured.
Robert,
uh-huh.
You file things for the news.
Yeah.
Do you buy this, that a news reporter does these two things simultaneously, scares and then reassures
no.
and then
no,
scares?
No, you never go cover the governor and say, first I'm going to scare them and then I'm going to assuage them. No one would do that.
But why else would you talk that way? I mean, not you.
Oh.
But I mean, the anchors, well, sometimes you actually.
Well, the form of the news is because the guy is always there, because he's an anchor, that's what the word means, it is a reassuring thing to see them night after night telling and telling. But Lavilio says that the real genius of the War of the Worlds was that Welles put you into a newscast where you expect anchors to anchor and you expect reporters to report, and then he kills the reporter and the anchor, and suddenly you're left all by yourself in your own living room all alone.
That is exactly right. The moment of the War of the Worlds broadcast, which still, frankly, terrifies me, it's this moment right here.
It strikes him head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks, and the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
It's like that silence is terrifying. No anchor, no reporter, no one to reassure you. Okay, but forgetting that for a moment, what about his second lesson that he had to teach us, the thing about don't believe the radio? What about that? Did it work?
Well, Professor Lavilio says if that is really what Welles was trying to do, if you believe that, well, then he failed. Actually, he worse than failed. The War of the Worlds, not once, Not twice. We've shown you three broadcasts tonight. It was so good at grabbing an audience and sucking them in that the Wells formula, you might call it, the newscast that scares you enough to keep you listening, has been adopted by, of all folks, news companies.
Right now at 11, a night of shopping turns into a night of fear.
Swarming over borders, flooding cities and towns, Muslim immigrants.
Teens texting and driving. It's a deadly mix.
Terror in the toilet.
And sinkholes and landslides.
Python in the pot.
A rapid baby goat terrorist working at one of our airports.
So many newscasts tease you with things that aren't quite true. Terror in the toilet, pythons in the potty. Maybe there was some snake somewhere near a toiletry facility of some kind, but it probably wasn't a python, and it probably wasn't your toilet. But you don't know that. You want to hear that it belongs to Mrs. James C. McGillicuddy of 2214 Beaudet Boulevard, and not you. So you want to be reassured, and so you listen, and so you fall in. And if Orson Welles retelling a Martian invasion story by H.G. Wells that most people already knew, if he could grab us, and then if they could do it again in Ecuador, and then if they can do it again in Buffalo, what does that tell you? It tells you that we can't help ourselves. Even if the headline is slightly preposterous, even if it's slightly scary, even if it's slightly false, we will listen.
The fear that these broadcasts generate now suck us in, and you'd think that 70 years later we'd be more sophisticated and critical when the local newscaster tells us that there's something we're feeding our children that could kill them, and they'll tell us after the news. I still listen. I'm a media critic, and I still wait through the commercials to see what is it that I'm doing to kill my child.
Even if it's really implausible, your shoelaces will kill you after this beef method.
Somehow it gets me every time.
Yeah, and Wells knew.
Radiolab is produced by Jada Boomrat with Lulu Miller, Tony Field, Rob Christensen, and Ellen Horn. Production support from Heather Radke, Michael Orion McManus, Laura Vitale, Ariel Lasky, Soren Wheeler, Linda Everts, Larissa Anderson, Sandin Totten, Molly Bloom, Bradley Campbell, and Ambada Espinosa.
Special thanks to Chris Worthington, Tom Keith, Zoe Keating, Tony Bull, Michael Grandchamp, Tom Campbell, Joe Bevilacqua, Laura Vitale, Oliver Conan, Nadia Ryman, Roberta Williams, Lorraine Maddox, Scott Goldberg, Andy Lancet, Limor Tomor, and Charles Michelet.
Original music for this hour was provided by cellist Zoe Keating. Check out zoekeating.com. You'll thank us.
Before we close our show today, I just want to remind you that anything that you heard today, anything you've ever heard on Radiolab, can be found at radiolab.org. That is our address. And while you're there, I would encourage you to email us. Radiolab@wnyc.org is our email address. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for listening.